Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Since the year 2000, ambitious young evangelicals have made their way to Patrick Henry College, a small Christian school near Washington, D.C. Most of them are homeschoolers whose idealism and discipline put the average American teenager to shame. At God's Harvard, they're groomed to become tomorrow's elite, dispatched to the front lines of politics, entertainment, and science to, quote, take back a godless nation, unquote. Hannah Rosen, author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save America, visits the nerve center of the evangelical movement and describes who they are, their background, goals, and desires. Hannah Rosen and I began our conversation when I asked her what motivated her to write God's Harvard.
After the 2004 elections, I was covering religion and politics for the Washington Post, and there was a lot of talk about the values vote and how evangelicals had made such a big difference in that election. And I wanted to find a place to tell that story of evangelicals having moved from the sort of fringes of politics into the mainstream. And so I looked around, and instead of picking a church or a town to go to, I remembered a place called Patrick Henry College, which had been founded in the year 2000. Explicitly to involve young Christians in politics. So I thought that might be a good place to tell that story.
And this is the Patrick Henry of give me liberty or give me death speech.
It's the same Patrick Henry. The reason that conservative Christians appreciate Patrick Henry is, for one, they think a lot about the founding fathers and exactly how America was or wasn't founded as a Christian nation. And when they do that evaluation, Patrick Henry comes up looking the best because he came closest to advocating state-sponsored religion. That's not quite what he advocated, but he came closer than anybody else.
But he's also one of the people who did not sign the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence.
Correct, and that's actually something that some of the more progressive professors at the school never hesitate to remind their students that when they're worshiping Patrick Henry, they have to remember that, you know, he did not want to sign the Constitution, and so that's a contradiction within him that people do bring up all the time.
Well, your book, God's Harvard, a Christian College on a Mission to Save America, spends a lot of time revealing the interviews that you had with young college age people, 18 to early 20s, a time of vulnerability, a time of catharsis, a time of movement in their life. They're focused, you say, from homeschools.
Yes, yes.
How do you see the homeschooling being different than the public school student?
Homeschooling is a movement that became very popular in the 90s. It's been around for a while, and many people have homeschooled. But in the 90s, conservative Christians decided that public schools were not doing service to their children, that they were reading the wrong kinds of books and picking up the wrong kinds of values, both from the public school system and from their peers. And so there came to be this large movement of parents wanting to homeschool their children. And the founder of Patrick Henry College was actually quite pivotal in that movement because it was illegal in many states, and he is a constitutional lawyer, and he fought for the rights of homeschooling parents to be able to keep their kids at home.
And homeschooling being illegal in many states.
It's not anymore, but it was at the time, and so what he did, you would get fined if you kept your children at home, and so he fought a lot of court cases which allowed parents to then keep their children at home. The founder of Patrick Henry College. And then these children came of age, and he basically thought, well, there's really no place for them to go after they've, you know, the parents have invested so much in their education, so where are they going to go now? So that's one of the reasons why he founded Patrick Henry College, to have a place for them to go to college that he felt would be safe and also very ambitious.
If you were to characterize the students who attend Patrick Henry College, or PHC, what would you say?
I would say that they are, one, conservative Christians. Two, they're very, very ambitious. So you would only go to Patrick Henry has a reputation among conservative Christians of being very, very rigorous academically, and so that the average SAT score is just below 1300, which is just below an Ivy League level. That's about the level of someplace like the University of Virginia. And so they're very smart, very ambitious, very committed, very passionate, and very committed to this notion of shape the culture and take back the nation. That's the phrase that they use all the time.
When you say smart, does that imply that they have a volume of knowledge, or they're able to integrate that knowledge?
Well, they don't yet have a volume of knowledge, because when they are homeschooled, they really do learn things from explicitly a Christian perspective. So they haven't been exposed to many, many perspectives. I think that comes later in their life. I just mean that they're very focused and dedicated. So it may be that they're not in raw smarts, smarter than any other, than your average, you know, pretty smart college student, but they really are able to focus their skills to this particular mission.
You mentioned conservative Christians, and then you later mentioned from a Christian perspective. What are those elements? What is a conservative Christian, and what is the Christian perspective?
Well, often I get often people criticize me for using loosely the word evangelical or Christian, and I think it is a good criticism, because there are obviously many kinds of Christians. There are Christians who would find the Patrick Henry mission, you know, fairly horrifying. There are others who would really, really support it, so you can't lump all Christians in one. When I say conservative Christians, I am referring to a particular, almost political movement that has arisen in the last 40 years, which we kind of loosely and lazily call evangelical sometimes, but who are committed to a particular worldview, as they call it, a Christian worldview, and a set of political principles.
How would you define the Christian worldview?
The Christian worldview is difficult to define. I think most generally you would say it's anything that furthers the cause of Christ. And so, for example, when there are movie websites which evaluate movies on whether they promote the Christian worldview, so sometimes it's something very literal, like how many curses do they use or how much nudity is there. And sometimes it's just a general sense of kind of how sarcastic and ironic is this movie. Does it really promote family values? Does it promote the kinds of things that we would like to see in our homes? So it's a vaguer thing than just the kind of literal fundamentalist, you know, are there people drinking in this movie and are they getting naked? It's a more generalized principle.
So it's somewhat different than some people interpreting Jesus to say, do unto others, or forgive those who have trespassed against you.
Exactly. It's very different. I mean, of course, they believe in those principles as well, but I think a Christian worldview has come to mean something very specific, which in the political realm we might think of as just family values. It's something like that. There's a movement of the religious left, and they're often criticizing the religious right for the kinds of things you're talking about. You know, what about the basic things that Jesus talked about, you know, helping the poor, do unto others? And so this is an argument that goes back and forth, where the left says that the right is misinterpreting what it is that Jesus wanted them to do and what Christian principles are, and interpreting in this very sort of narrow, fundamentalist, restrictive way.
Going back to 2000, when George W. Bush was campaigning, there was a lot of information about his form of Christianity, evangelical at the time, but that word was never really mentioned by him during the course of his campaigns. Is that connected with Patrick Henry College?
Yes. What Bush did and what was happening around the time of 2004 was that candidates were learning to communicate with this with evangelicals in a way that wasn't so explicit, that you wouldn't necessarily get up at a rally and talk about Jesus or get up at a rally and talk about abortion. You would do something much more subtle. What Bush did was tell his life story about how he had been an alcoholic and then had took a walk on the beach with Billy Graham, and from that day forward his life changed. Now, I think the story was very sincere. I don't think he was making it up, but he told the story in the particular formula which any Christian would recognize as a Christian testimony, that is something that every Christian kind of has as a narrative of their life, of the moment when they truly found Jesus. And so I think candidates learned how to communicate and speak what some people call evangelese, which is the language of evangelicals, without explicitly committing to any kinds of policies.
So when someone finds Jesus, what does that mean?
What it means is we sometimes casually refer to it as born again. It just means that they really now, their life is completely different, that every decision and action they make, and this isn't for everyone, I'm speaking of Patrick Henry, a very committed Christian, it means that every action they do, they kind of have what they call conversation with God going on in their head, or what the Holy Spirit will tell them to do. It operates, I suppose, like a conscience, and other people have told me that it operates sort of like a spousal relationship where you really do check all of your decisions. Is it right for me to say this? Is it right for me to do this? Is this what I should be doing at this moment? Is this what God called me to do? So you really subject almost every decision. It's like a new veil goes over your life, and you subject almost every decision to that principle.
Yet when perhaps a person who hasn't found Jesus or who has not been born again checks what they're doing and reviews their principles, that's often done in conversation with a trusted partner, a trusted confidant. Is that done in this checking that you refer to?
Yes, although it's a little bit different. They would say that even though that's the closest analogy they can come up with for someone like me who's not a Christian, that's not what the thing itself is really like, because your confidant or your partner could be amoral or immoral. So checking with God sort of in structure works the same way. The procedure is the same. I mean, I guess what they're trying to convey to me is that the intimacy is pretty much the same, but that because it's God or Jesus that you're checking with, you're always going to get the correct moral answer if you're doing the process correctly.
What I find curious about doing the process is, what are the standards? Because we all see the world, all 6.5 billion of us, from our own eyes, from our own experience. It's the interpretation that I'm looking for.
Right. And that's something that when I was on campus was very difficult for me to grasp, because there was a sense of certainty about knowing what God's will was for you, and sort of a lack of acknowledgement. And this is a fine line many Christians walk, but a lack of acknowledgement that, you know, this was yourself making that decision, or that you had a particular perspective, or there was no real way of knowing that God had destined you to do this or that, or to go to Patrick Henry, or to work in politics, or whatever it was that they had the sense that God had told them to do and the mission that they had been put on. So it's the kind of thing you'd have to ask a Christian to explain better than I ever could, where that sense of certainty comes from.
Well, I want to ask you, Hannah Rosen, about the difficulty in grasping that concept. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Hannah Rosen. She's a reporter for the Washington Post covering religion and politics, and she's the author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save America. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Hannah Rosen, how did you resolve that difficulty in grasping the dichotomy of your interpretation of what the students at Patrick Henry College were saying and your own beliefs?
I didn't really seek to resolve that, except to just be frank about my beliefs and just to kind of watch how their beliefs impacted them and changed them. So I didn't actually feel any push to kind of, or pull to reconcile. I certainly felt the pull from a journalistic perspective to understand, and it was quite difficult for me to understand how you would have a constant conversation with God and live in the modern world. And that's always their challenge. So I guess I set myself the challenge of just trying to understand as best as I could a world that's relatively foreign to me.
In your personal experience, having been born in Israel, grown up in a conservative Jewish home, and to some extent still following that faith, there is an interpretation of guidance, of religious guidance. What sort of comparison was given to you by the people at Patrick Henry College?
To Judaism, you mean?
Yes.
Evangelicals have a particular relationship with Jews. They feel close to Jews because Jews are people of the Bible and the chosen people. On the other hand, they're kind of, Jews are just stand as a frustrating example because they so conspicuously rejected Jesus. And so so Jews present a particular challenge and fascination for them. So I would always get, I would often get people intensely interested in sort of what it was like to be Jewish. And they tend to see Jews as kind of unformed Christians, kind of Christians waiting to happen, which of course is not how I see Jews, but that was the kinds of conversations we would have. Now, because they were kids and I was a grown-up, they didn't, you know, try and aggressively convert me or anything, although I did have fairly intense conversations with some of their parents, you know, which would get to the heart of the matter, such as, well, why did you reject Jesus? You know, are you saying Jesus is a fraud? And they weren't, you know, being antagonistic, but they were asking me the central question, which is the true question of what Jews believe.
How do you see Jews?
Jews or Jesus?
Jews.
You mean in terms of what they believe?
Yes.
Well,
and that's a wide spectrum question.
Right, that's a wide spectrum question. I suppose I don't see them any particular way, but the thing I would try and explain to the people at Patrick Henry who would ask me that question is that Jews are not, they don't actually think a lot about Jesus. In other words, it's not a big part of our theology, so they would always want to know, well, why did you reject Jesus? What do Jews have to say about that? And, you know, the truest answer would be that it's a footnote in Jewish history, but we don't have the New Testament. We don't believe in the New Testament, and so we don't even call it the Old Testament and the New Testament. So it's a strange thing to ask us constantly what we make of Jesus. It's, you know, we have a thousand, Jews have a thousand other questions and ways of looking at ethical and moral questions that don't involve Jesus at all.
Throughout the diaspora of the Jews in the world, there is enough variance or as much variance as there is of the Christians in their diaspora of the world.
Right, of course. I mean, there's you know, in the same sense that Christians accuse me and Jews or East Coast people of having a kind of cartoon image or a flat image of what an evangelical Christian is like, I think the same could be said about evangelical Christians and Jews, where they're not really that familiar with the distinctions between Jews. They think, you know, they have this stereotype that Jews are sort of secular Jews or like Jerry Seinfeld Jews. They're not really Jewish. And of course, there are all kinds of Jews. They're very Orthodox Jews. They're very charismatic Jews, the way there are charismatic Christians. And there are, you know, Israeli Jews and American Jews and European Jews and, you know, down to Reform Jews and down to pretty secular Jews all on down the line. So that's something that they really weren't that familiar with. Not surprisingly, but they weren't.
Well, let's talk more about Patrick Henry College. And one of their goals, as you have mentioned and describe in some detail in your book, is to take back the nation. To take it back from what?
To take it back from the place that it's gotten to, they have this sense that the nation has really gone astray, you know, that the values in America that we now have, you know, we're tipping towards gay marriage and there are abortions in America and all the usual things that you hear from the Christian right, they really feel like the nation has lost its way and that it was once founded on Christian principles and they would like to return it to those Christian principles.
How do they propose to do that?
Well, there are different ways they propose to do it. They propose to elect godly leaders to government. That's one way to do it, to get our nation back on track. That would include Supreme Court justices and people in Congress and people who are godly, basically, and could espouse godly principles. Now, there are more extreme versions of Patrick Henry, people who would say, well, we just want a theocracy, you know, we just want... But I think those are few and far between. That's a criticism that some people would make of the Bush administration, the people surrounding the Bush administration. But I think that even people at Patrick Henry are realistic enough to know that such a thing could never happen in America, that what you could have is electing a lot of, you know, Christian leaders to government, which the nation already has done.
Well, notwithstanding what we may be in the midst of, that is a backlash to George W. Bush's leadership now in September of 2007, preparing for the presidential elections in 14 months. Do you see much success coming from Patrick Henry College and their manner of educating young people?
I think that they will continue to educate young people exactly the way they always have. They're in the new mode of Christian colleges. There are many other Christian colleges that have the same mission as Patrick Henry, which is to say they no longer have the mission of, you know, training Christians to just live a sort of quiet Christian parallel a life in a parallel kind of universe. They really do have the aim to have them be ambitious and join the mainstream. So in terms of the way they do education, it's the same. Now, in terms of what kind of influence they can have, I think that remains to be seen, because the as you said, the elections, the landscape has changed. In 2006, many Republicans lost their seats, and among them were many conservative Christians, and the presidential candidates, none of them are clearly, there's going to be as clear of an ally as George Bush was. You have, you know, you have a choice of a Mormon who, while he espouses the same conservative principles, is not an evangelical Christian, and then you have a couple of candidates who are on their, you know, second and third marriages, so they're certainly alien in some way to evangelical Christians. And so it's not so clear what the landscape will be, although given their dedication and how firmly they are established in Washington, I think they won't have trouble finding jobs elsewhere, even if not in the White House.
Let's go back to the student body at Patrick Henry College. The behavior of college kids. You spend a portion of your book talking about the directed attitudes towards sexual behavior and the behavior or the communication between young men and young women at Patrick Henry College. Can you share that with us?
Yes, that's, I think, the first thing that would strike someone who's not familiar with Christian colleges and has only been to a secular college. The codes of conduct at Christian colleges, and especially at Patrick Henry, are quite different than they would be at a secular college. There are rules on how people can dress, partly to prepare them for professional jobs, but partly for reasons of modesty, so that if a woman had a bra strap showing or midriff showing, she, or, you know, if her skirt was too short, she would get an email from an RA and maybe even have to go talk to the dean of students. There's no, you wouldn't see kids walking around with messy hair or ripped jeans or playing loud music or holding hands or anything like that. They also follow what's called the courtship principles, which is to say they don't really believe in dating. They believe in courtship, which means you can only really start spending exclusive time with a woman or man if you have intention to marry them, and you would have to involve their parents, so call their parents and let them know that you're going to do that, and there would be very little physical contact. And, you know, different students follow these rules to different degrees of seriousness, but certainly some would follow them all the way, which is to say save their first kiss for their wedding day.
In terms of hormonally driven behavior of people that age, did you observe a conflict?
Well, that's the thing that I found initially extremely interesting about Patrick Henry, that here are kids who are young and going through a time of turmoil and a time when, you know, hormones are raging and you had your so this is a time of sort of maximum turmoil for many people, and yet they had this tremendous responsibility on them and this tremendous kind of conscience on them. So there certainly were conflicts that came, and when I write the book, I choose different characters, and some of my characters are people who live happily within the system, who are kind of earnest about the mission and are able to carry it out. And other characters are people who are chafing against the system and who have a really hard time with it, and who get in trouble. So that one of my chapters is about an incident that happened in the first semester where a bunch of kids got in a lot of trouble for drinking, and it's just about the way the school kind of brought them down and how their friends turned them in, and sort of everything that happens when you have a set of pretty rigid rules, things that can go wrong. As I write in the book, there's certainly some ways in which it's romantic and sweet and it looks like a mid-century Broadway play, but there are other ways in which it can get pretty oppressive.
You also talk about how the guy is supposed to be the leader in the relationship with the girl.
Right, that's absolutely true, yes.
Does that conflict with the changing position of women in our society now?
Well yes. One thing that when the kids criticize my point of view or things that I've written in the book, one thing they do say is that, you know, I write from a modern feminist bias, and I think I have to confess that that's true. One thing that happened in the 70s was that, and I write a little bit about this cultural history of the religious right, is that conservative Christian leaders started to notice that their own their own people had drifted the way the rest of America was going. There seemed to be just as many divorces among conservative Christians and just as many women with young children working, and they became very worried about that. So the Christian advice literature of the 70s tried to reverse that, and one way they did that was by very explicitly reinserting this principle of what a man's role was and what a woman's role was, and they felt that that was the key to regaining lost Christian values. And so the kids who are now, you know, children of the people, their parents were the one reading this advice literature, feel that pretty strongly. So that even women who are quite ambitious, and the women are encouraged to be just as ambitious and are in fact just as successful at Patrick Henry, know that as soon as they stop, that as soon as they have children, they would stop whatever job they have, you know, working at Karl Rove's office, working wherever, working in a successful magazine to raise their children.
And remove themselves from the mainstream politic.
They would basically, you know, but that's not to say they would totally drop out. They would have other things that they would like to do, maybe. But those things would generally have to do with raising the children. So I've certainly seen some of the women decide that they're going to start, say, a homeschool debate league or something like that. But they would basically drop out of the mainstream work world.
Well, let's talk about praying. How would they define the verb to pray?
That's a really good question. They often say, you know, how do you pray? I'm not sure how they would define it. I can say what I witness, which is that people would pray quite often, and sometimes they would pray out loud, and sometimes they would pray, you know, for thank God or to ask the blessings of God on any kind of activity that they were doing, and sometimes they would pray silently, and in the mornings they would read their Bible. So it really, I think their aim is to sort of be praying nonstop in some form all day long and sort of not lose it, not save it just for the contemplative periods, but integrate it into everything they do.
Perhaps in creating a thought pattern and repeating a thought pattern to bring it into being by use?
Yes, I think that they would, that, you know, when people would, I would hear people say them, but I don't know how to pray, or they would tell a story about how they, you know, taught someone how to pray, and the answer would always be, well, just do it, just try it, just start talking, just get into the habit of it. So I think in their case, they've pretty much been in the habit of it for a long, long time.
Well, Hannah Rosen, author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save America, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I can. I have recently been reading, and in fact, I'm about to write about the Philip Pullman series called His Dark Materials, and which the first of the series, which is called The Golden Compass, is about to be made into a major film, which will come out in December. So I'm actually I reread the series for a second time, and it's a really wonderful series, although a great challenge to people who believe in God, which is why I'm interested in, because it gets into a lot of interesting theological questions.
Do you believe in God?
I do, yes.
Well, Hannah Rosen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much.
Hannah Rosen is the author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save America. The book that she recommends is The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman. There's a discussion guide available about God's Harvard at www.godsharvard.com. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. At Radio Curious, we appreciate hearing from you. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. The snail mail is 700 West Smith Street in Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.